The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Richard Lee, and this is the Guardian Books Podcast.
She was the fourth of five children born on a cold January night by lamplight, power cut, in Shah Jahanabad, the walled city of Delhi. Ahlam Baji, the midwife who delivered her and put her in her mother's arms, wrapped in two shawls, said, "It's a boy." Given the circumstances, her error was understandable. A month into her first pregnancy, Jahanara Begum and her husband decided that if their baby was a boy, they would name him Aftab. Their first three children were girls. They had been waiting for their Aftab for 6 years. The night he was born was the happiest of Jahanara Begum's life. The next morning, when the sun was up and the room nice and warm, she unswaddled little Aftab. She explored his tiny body, eyes, nose, head, neck, armpit, fingers, toes, with sated, unhurried delight. That was when she discovered, nestling underneath his boy parts, a small, unformed, but undoubtedly girl part. Is it possible for a mother to be terrified of her own baby? Jahanara Begum was.
The little-known Indian writer Arundhati Roy won the 1997 Booker Prize with her first novel, The God of Small Things, a debut which went on to sell more than 8 million copies and made Roy into a global celebrity. For the next two decades, she turned to activism, becoming a formidable campaigner for justice and the environment. But now she's returned to fiction with The Ministry of Utmost Happiness, the story of a transgender woman known in India as a Hijra, and her guest house, home to an eccentric cast of fellow outcasts. The Guardian's Decca Aitkenhead sat down with Roy in front of a live audience at the Union Chapel in London and talked to her about coming back to fiction and her outspoken criticisms of the Indian government. She began by asking if Roy had felt any pressure to write a second novel.
You know, truthfully, nobody hassled me because I think everybody who was involved with the publication of the first book, and most particularly David Godwin, my agent, they knew that you can only be hassled if you're unsure of what you're going to do next and if you're open to being hassled. But I was not open to being hassled. You know, I knew that I was, I didn't see it as my professional duty to keep producing books. And I knew that when the people and the creatures arrived, if and when they arrived, all I could do was to wait. And they would come, and I wasn't even waiting. I mean, they just arrived, and it was okay. If I hadn't written another book, I would have been okay too, you know.
And I believe you began the book in 2007, 10 years ago. Has it been something that you've come to and then left behind and turned to other things and come back to, or has it been a constant process in the last decade?
Yeah, I mean, I think it might have been 2007 when I really sort of maybe set down the first stirrings of fiction. But fiction is a prison. When you allow it to just lock, it really, you know, I mean, I've been in prison and I know what it feels like when the gates shut, you know, and you're like, okay, now it's not going to let you go until it decides that it will let you go. So, you know, the thing is, I could not have written this book without the 20 years of all my other writing, which is not to say that it was research, but it was like making the map of a great city with main roads and side roads and blind alleys, and you can't just drive through the main road and say, oh, I know the city, you know? So to me, it's like either a sedimentary rock with many layers, or it's a city, or it's just the air and the things that float around in the air. And when people ask me, when did you start writing, or how do you write? I don't know, because I'm always writing. You know, when I'm running, I'm writing. When I'm cooking, I'm writing, when I'm all the time, it's, you know, just, it just keeps going on and on and on, so, yeah.
Now, the book publishes tomorrow, so I'm guessing that most of the people here may have seen a review or two, but won't have had the pleasure of reading the novel. I can tell you it is more than well worth the wait. It's populated by one of the most extraordinary fictional casts I think I've ever come across. We have Anjum, the transsexual, very single-minded character who ends up living in building a guest house in a graveyard. We have a kind of shambling, drunken wreck of a government man. We have an untouchable who renames himself Saddam Hussein, which is an interesting choice of rebrand. We have an abandoned baby, which I cannot overstate the extent to which each page is populated by this exuberant, luxuriant cast of people that you want to spend as much time as you possibly can with. I'm interested to know what drew you to make one of your, I would say protagonist, but it should probably be chief protagonist. There are many protagonists in the book. Anjum, why would you have chosen what's known in India as a hijra, what we would call an intersex or transsexual? What drew you to make her one of your chief protagonists?
She chose me. No, seriously. To me, you know, this book, all the characters in this book actually have a border running through them. So Anjum has the border of gender running through her. Saddam Hussein, who's a Dalit man who watches his father being beaten to death by what we call Gau Rakshaks, you know, the cow warriors, the right-wing Hindu mob. And he converts to Islam simply because he sees a video and he carries it on his phone. He has a video of Saddam Hussein's execution and he says, you know what, I want to do what I have to do and then I want to die like this, because he's very impressed with the dignity that Saddam shows at his execution. So he has the border of caste and religious conversion. One of the other major characters called Tilotama, she too has a border of caste in her. Her mother's a Syrian Christian and her father is clearly a Dalit man, but she doesn't know who he is, but there are all these rumors in the small town she came from. The government officer who you speak about, his name is Biplob Dasgupta, but they all call him Garson Hobart because that's the character he played in a school play. And he is half the voice of the establishment and the other half this kind of shambling, thwarted wreck of a lover. And then you have Musa Yesvi, who's Kashmiri, who has this incendiary border, a national border really running through him. So in some ways, everybody has what one of the characters in the Khwabga, in the dream house where Anjum ends up living, with a whole variety of different kinds of gender groups and very, in a very traditional way and in a very traditional place. One of the characters called Nimmo Gorakhpuri says, you know, we have Indo-Pak inside us, like this battle always. But all of them have a kind of Indo-Pak, you know, and in some ways it's like if The God of Small Things was a book about a family with a broken heart at its center, this is a book about people who have been driven out of society by this big engine that decides who is whom and what identities are acceptable and not. And then they bring their shattered hearts, those fragments of their broken hearts together and make a mended heart, you know?
You talk about all of the characters having borders running through them. Are these characters that you have met in your life, are these the people that you're drawn to in your daily life, would you say?
Yes and no. I mean, you know, fiction is such a osmotic thing, you know, so it's not as if any of the characters are absolutely real people, but surely, you know, one of the things that sometimes puzzles me is how people keep referring to it as magic realism, and I'm like, it's not your realism, but it's not magical. This is the kind of thing we live with all the time, you know? And it's sure there are parts where the characters themselves have fevered reveries. But to me, what was interesting to try and do was to put it crudely, you know, now all of us, especially in the younger generation, pedagogy itself is being NGO-ized, you know, so everything is like a kind of funding unit. So, okay, you're a specialist in caste, you're a specialist in gender, you're a specialist in, you know, Kashmir, you're a specialist in gender politics or sex trafficking or whatever. And really, the challenge is that this is all part of the world, you know, and this is the air we breathe. And how does it connect up? What is this core of vicious nationalism that pushed Anjum into the graveyard, that has tens of thousands of people killed in Kashmir, that has the most densely militarized zone in the world and everybody's calling it a democracy, that has laws which allow soldiers to just kill on suspicion? What is it that connects all of this? You know, for that you need literature, you need fiction.
You write in the book that Kashmir is an incubator for every kind of insanity, and indeed a torturer who flees to England ends up killing himself. Is this a conflict that sends everyone involved mad to some extent?
Well, to a great extent. I mean, if you look at what is going on, what happened last summer in Kashmir, where they were firing pellet guns into the crowd, blinding people. Today, you look at the papers, you have young girls, school girls in school uniforms, you know, throwing rocks at armed soldiers. You have people standing up and cheering because a young Kashmiri man was tied to an armored vehicle and used as a human shield, and he's been rewarded with a gallantry award. You know, you have things that you would never consider acceptable. But of course, you know, the thing is that you look at other democracies, they are involved in similar things, but not inside their own countries, you know, outside. But the charade of what we call democracy today is something we need to understand, what we call nationalism.
It's sometimes said of Prime Minister Modi and Donald Trump that they are two peas in the same pod. It's often said. Mm. Is there any truth in that?
I don't think so. You know, I don't think so at all, because Trump is like somebody who has risen from the effluent of a system gone wrong, you know? And but so even what we call the deep state or the established, the big institutions of state that remain there regardless of when, whether there are elections or not, the deep state is also a bit suspicious of him. Whereas Modi is a product of a person who belongs to an organization called the RSS, which stands for the Rashtriya Swayam Sevak Sangh, which was set up in 1925, inspired by Mussolini's black shirts, who have consistently maintained that India must be declared a Hindu nation. And it is a ruthlessly efficient organization. It has hundreds of thousands of workers on the ground. It has peopled all the institutions. It's been at work, hard at work, for 100 years. It cannot be laughed at in the way Trump can be, because it's extremely serious and has penetrated every institution. And now history is being rewritten. History textbooks are being rewritten. The new generation, if this goes on, is going to be, you know, their minds are going to be altered by all of this. And you have, I mean, every day you, like, we are witnessing lynchings on the street of Muslims, of Dalits, people who are being accused of moving cattle because the holy cow has become the national emblem and so on. So I would not say that Donald Trump and Modi are two peas in a pod at all.
Sounds as if you think the Modi is the more dangerous of the two.
Certainly, I certainly think he's the more dangerous, yeah.
To lots of people here, you will be considered first and foremost a political activist and a polemicist for all of the work you've done politically in the last few, over the last two decades and more. I'm wondering to what extent you worry now for your own physical safety.
Well, look, I mean, lots of people in India need to worry, you know, and people who are very, very vulnerable. You know, huge populations of Muslims and Dalits need to worry because for every person that's lynched, it's a lesson to the village or to the community. If your suitcase falls off the berth of a train and you happen to be a Muslim or a Dalit, you don't know what's going to happen to you. So I don't want to kind of overdo my own worry about myself. And also, you know, there's an organized assault on the internet. I mean, it's an organized process. And so, especially against women.
And do you mean that this violence against women or this anger against women pervades all aspects of sort of political belief and society?
See, the thing
India?
Is with women, you know, I mean, people ask me to speak about Indian women, I'll say, which woman? Because, you know, there's such a range of, I mean, the freest, fiercest women that I know live in that country. And then you have, obviously, you have female feticide and female infanticide. And, you know, because of caste, there is a kind of accepted hierarchical ownership of women and the right to rape them or take them over. Upper caste can just go in and take over a woman. But then you have these military administered societies where, again, women are very vulnerable. And then you have the anger against the younger woman who's modernizing, who's got ambitions, who's changing, whose idea about her place in society is changing.
One of the tactics used against yourself and many others in India is action through the courts, judicial action, lawsuits, endless lawsuits. I have to put my hand up. I'm not even sure I could, and I've really tried to get my head around the various legal actions against you, and they are so infernally complicated and everlasting and mysteriously opaque. I don't think I can get to the bottom of them. I wonder sometimes whether you're even able to keep track of all the various different legal actions.
Well, there's one very simple way of remembering it. Every few years, five male lawyers get together and file a case against me. So when I wrote The God of Small Things, of course, they charged me with obscenity and corrupting public morality. And that was because they objected to the last scene in the book. And after I won the Booker Prize, we would all be ready for the argument, and the judge would come and say, every time this case comes before me, I get chest pains. Then that went on for about 10 years. The second time, five lawyers got together and accused me, and I promise you, of trying to kill them outside the gates of the Supreme Court at a protest that I wasn't even at. And already the court had warned me because I had written this essay about big dams and displacement. It was called The Greater Common Good. And at that point, I'd said, you know, to snatch an indigenous person's land and give them cash compensation is like paying a Supreme Court judge his salary in fertilizer bags. So they sort of warned me and said, you don't behave yourself. And then when these men filed this case and they were upset with my reply, and they would keep throwing my book from one brother judge to the next, and I would be called that woman. So I used to call myself the hooker that won the Booker. Then I was actually eventually sentenced to a day in prison for that. Survived that. But then now again five guys have got together and filed another case. I mean, they didn't file it. They asked the judge to file it, which he did. because a professor who I actually know well, who's 90% disabled, he's in a wheelchair, and he was thrown into prison called a Maoist terrorist. His wheelchair broke. He was crawling around on all fours in his prison cell, and I wrote an article called Professor POW, and basically I said, you know, you need to give him bail because he'll die in prison before you finish trying him. He was given bail, but then I was charged with contempt of court, and I'm still being tried for that. And meanwhile, he has been...
As I said, it's quite complicated.
He's been... But he has been sentenced to life imprisonment, so he's back in prison, and it's...
And your case continues to be ongoing?
Yes.
Is it sheer incompetence and sort of bureaucratic muddle that means that these things churn on and on and on, or is there a deliberate element?
No, sometimes it is, but sometimes it is that, you know, the judiciary is very lofty, and it doesn't take account of how hard it is for ordinary people to get lawyers, to make court appearance. You can just, that can just destroy your life. You know, after 20 years, you might get a very erudite judgment. But, you know, meanwhile, people's lives are destroyed, you know. And it's very hard for journalists or for ordinary people to manage to handle that. And so people file, I mean, one of the very favored tactics of the right-wing groups is to file cases in many cities, let's say against a writer or a journalist. And so it just kind of debilitates you, you know? So
because you have to attend court in all
yeah,
these different locations.
And they use the slow turning wheels of the judiciary as a, I mean, the process is the punishment. They know that, you know?
Obviously, The God of Small Things made you hugely globally famous, more or less overnight. And some of what you're describing is the price that you've paid for that degree of success and fame. Were there ever moments when, and this may sound like a funny question, when you almost regretted the success of The God of Small Things, or wished you could turn back the clock to your anonymity?
Yes, there were. There were. Because when I wrote the book, I didn't even know that kind of fame or success was possible, you know. I thought, like, I'd written some lunatic fringe cinema and now it's downshifting, you know, and 17 people would read the book. And so it was never something that I, let's say, you know, I was never one, that kind of person who dreamt of being well-known or something. So it was hard, and also because, you know, if you become that well-known and then you move to London or New York and you move around with the beautiful people, it's fine. But if you don't, and you're like, I'm staying in this puddle with all my other fishy friends, and then all of them have to deal with it too, you know? So it's not just you, but everybody, and it's not easy for people, you know, because it's absurd, you know, what goes on. And so... yeah, that happened. And then also what happens is that, for example, just a few months after the Booker, and I was obviously the fairy princess on every magazine cover, and then the BJP, the right-wing government, came to power, did the nuclear test, and I was not able to be neutral, because if I had said nothing, it meant I would endorse it, because I was now the kind of face of the new global Indian or whatever, you know. So I had to take that position strongly. And once I did it, I just exited one kind of world and entered another.
Do you worry at all about comparisons being made between the two books, or are you fully prepared for that?
No, I don't worry at all. No, I don't.
Okay, let me ask the question a different way. Do you think this is a better book?
You know, somebody a few weeks ago, someone wrote to me and said, you know, I need to come and meet you because I want to talk to you about The God of Small Things. And I said to her, well, I won't be able to do that for a while because I've just had another one. And in the case of books, the newer one is the older sibling. So it's for me, you know, I was not trying to write The God of Small Things 2. And Estepan and Rahel and Amu and Velita also around me. I don't let anybody go, you know. So there's no competition. You know, to me it was, it has to be an experiment. It's not about success, or it's not about who thinks what, or who's going to say what, or who's going to sell what. You know, the idea is to grapple with something. The ambition is only an artistic one. It's not about critics or bestseller lists. Because I know, I mean, sorry to say this, but it's the truth, that when people read the book and think they are judging the book, Anjum and Thilo and the dogs and the vultures are also judging the reader. They're like, okay. So, really, truly, I mean, this is the truth. They are.
We have all been warned.
You're listening to the Guardian Books podcast with Arundhati Roy talking to Decca Aitkenhead. In the second half, we'll hear questions from the audience at this Guardian live event.
It's time now to open the floor to questions. There's a gentleman at the front here in a purple shirt.
You said that you've always been writing, which I understand. But before The God of Small Things, did you write anything down at all, like short stories, sketches, studies, anything like that? And might they ever be published?
Well, yes. Before I wrote The God of Small Things, I actually wrote the screenplay for two films that were both made. And also, actually, this essay writing started before. I mean, people don't know much about it, but I wrote a series of essays called The Great Indian Rape Trick, which was about this film called The Bandit Queen that was made. And of course, you know, my ambitions to be a writer started when I was about 5, because I had this missionary, Australian missionary teacher who would tell me regularly that she could see Satan in my eyes. So my first piece of writing said, "I hate Miss Mitten and I think her knickers are torn." So, yeah, it began.
I think you should definitely publish that one. Yeah. We can take some more questions now. There's somebody in a very red shirt there. That's right, yes.
You said that when you wrote The God of Small Things, you expected 17 people to read it. I was wondering if you've ever doubted your abilities as a writer, and if yes, how do you put those doubts aside and finish writing a whole novel?
Interesting question.
And also, I love you.
I love you too. Okay, so you know, whether 17 people read your book or 8 million people read your book, in a way, that isn't the only measure of your quality as a writer. You know, the person that you have to live up to is yourself, isn't it? And if you don't doubt your ability, that would be bad, right? So how do you move through those doubts to, you know, I had a physical sensation at some point in my life that I had found my language. Oh, it's almost like an artist, you know, you draw and you draw and you draw, and then you know that your line is your line, right? And that way, at some point, language became my friend. And I remember saying this years ago when someone asked me a question about The God of Small Things, and I said, language is the skin on my thought. And more naughtily, I remember once there was some World Water Forum or something at The Hague. And I knew that there was a delegation of Indian ministers who were going to defend privatization and dams. And so they had invited me to, and I just went there with the sole purpose of wrecking it. I was on this panel with people, and they said, you got to introduce yourselves and say why you write about water. So there was an American, I forgot his name, next to me, and he said, my name is whatever, and I write about water because I'm paid to. And I just want to say that God gave us the rivers, but he didn't put in the delivery system. And for this, we need private enterprise. And I said, well, I'm Arundhati Roy, and I write about water because I'd be paid a great deal not to. And I said, you know, I think something rude, like it's been a long time since I've been in a room full of dead people, but you all call yourselves writers, but writers spend a lifetime trying to close the gap between language and thought. And you spend a lifetime trying to devise a language to mask thought. So when you say deepening democracy, you mean the opposite. Yeah. So I think our doubts and our ghosts and our shadows that we fight are all part of finding or closing that gap between language and thought and being able to write what you think and not to feel that your thoughts and your words are at odds. But it takes time, but when it happens, there's nothing like it.
Now then, there's a gentleman there.
Can I ask
and
you,
there's this lady here.
Yes.
Can I ask about the reception of your work in India? Over 20 years, do you feel that for the God of Small Things and your political writings, what sense do you have that of the influence they've had on young people or on changing the culture or opening up a space in the culture?
I can't answer that in any empirical way, you know, but I think, well, when I write fiction, I do not have any goals or any ulterior reason. For me, it's just something that I remember, you know, David Godwin, my agent, would ask me, how's it going? And I would say, all I can do is concentrate. And then it writes itself, you know? So there isn't any immediate goal about changing the world or anything like that. With the nonfiction, there certainly is a goal which is not of changing the world, but just intervening in a situation, making a little space, giving people a little time at least, you know. But I think recently, as in last year, for example, there was a lot of student unrest on various campuses in India. And then one of the reasons for that was that the students were marking the anniversary, let's say, of the hanging of a man called Afzal Guru, who was one of the five quote-unquote terrorists who was imprisoned and then sentenced to death by the Supreme Court for an attack on the Indian Parliament in 2001. And I had actually followed that case extremely carefully, and four of the masterminds were acquitted, and then Afzal Guru was hanged, and in the judgment it really said in so many words that we don't have evidence to show that he's a member of a terrorist group, but in order to satisfy the collective conscience of society, we are sentencing him to death. And when I, at the time I wrote about it, before he was hanged, and of course there was the usual, you know, spare him and hang her and all that. But then, so many years later, students began to get very, very agitated about this. And then while all that was going on, literally on television, there was, on this very right-wing channel, there was this, you know, it's all right, these are just students, but who's the mind behind this, you know? Who's the one who wrote on the nuclear test? Who's the one who wrote, why is she, you know, at liberty? So I suppose it's not just me, but so many of us who have been swimming against the current. I do believe that at least somewhere, you know, there is a deep understanding among young people that something terrible is going on. At least there are battles in the campus, you know, which I think is good.
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you talked about stories that present themselves that are true. In Chhattisgarh, there's a woman who's now being victimized. She works for the state, Varsha Dongri, and she's actually said that Adivasi women in the prisons in Chhattisgarh are being tortured, being electrocuted. What could you say about how we reflect that, how we should support her if we do it all here?
Well, you know, the thing is that there are hundreds of people, hundreds of women and indigenous people in jails in central India. That is the conflict. I mean, it's part of the book, and I have also written at length about it. Anyone who resists is arrested, charged with sedition, or charged under the Unlawful Activities Prevention Act. That can, you can be jailed for 7 years for thinking an anti-government thought. And the lady that the gentleman talked about, earlier than that, there was an indigenous woman called Soni Sori who was arrested, who had stones pushed up her vagina, and then the police officer under whose auspices this happened was given a gallantry award. In Kashmir, tens of thousands of people have been killed. Hundreds continue to be killed. The torture in prisons across the country. But of course, it's all hidden behind this cuddly, Bollywoody democracy, you know, with the middle class, with wonderful cricket matches, and all of that goes on. But, you know, behind that, the difficulty and the, you know, the reason why it's more frightening than Trump is because all the institutions have been hollowed out, you know? And so you, right now, the only thing that remains is changing the constitution and declaring it a Hindu republic. But, you know, if you have members of parliament making statements about Muslims should all go to Pakistan, it's all allowed. Muslims should be cremated. Why should they be buried? All of this is happening out in the open. You know, so I mean, I'm sorry if this whole discussion has turned out to be pretty frightening, but the reason that I live there, the reason that I write there, the reason that I fight there is also because there's so much to love there, you know. There's so much beauty, so much music, so much anarchy, so much that is wonderful, that I would not give it up for the world, you know? And they keep saying that you're anti-national. I'm not anti-national, it's just that, I mean, I have nothing wrong with being anti-national. We should all be anti-national, that's fine. I'm just saying that, you know, there are things that I love about that place and things that are worth protecting, not just the forests and the rivers, but so much, you know. So, and I don't think this book is just about horror. It's also about love. It's not satirical title. It is about utmost happiness.
I can absolutely endorse that. It is a book full of joy and love and uproarious spirit.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was Arundhati Roy talking to Decca Aitkenhead. The Ministry of Utmost Happiness is published in the UK by Hamish Hamilton. That's all from us this week. You can join in the discussion on Twitter at Guardian Books or on the Guardian website. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast, which is also how you'll find us in your favourite podcast app. Next week, we'll be hearing Naomi Klein's call to action in a world of Brexit and Donald Trump. No is not enough. But for now, from me, Richard Lee, and our producer, Simon Barnard, thanks for listening and goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.